Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, your destination for all things lacrosse. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Not alongside me, but in studio is Jack Piatelli. Jack, how we doing?
I miss you. I miss you a lot. I don't know what I'm going to do without you in the studio.
Yeah.
Three episodes without you, and it looks like it's going to be many, many more. I don't know. I'm losing my sleep over it.
Yeah, I'm sure you're real broken up. But yeah, listen, just get someone else. You'll be fine. I'm gonna be out. I actually was talking to them. I was like, "Well, after the surgery, do you like want me to write articles? Because those are gonna get weird. Like, I'm gonna be on painkillers. It's gonna be real weird." And they just kind of looked at me. I was like, "I'm joking, right?"
Yeah. No opioids. No opioids, please.
Yeah. No. I'm on for a week, and then I'm just gonna be on tour at all. I think because my body doesn't react well to the other stuff. So enough about that. Let's welcome in our guest, Trinity head coach Jason Tarnow. Coach, how we doing?
I'm great. How are you guys? And thank you for having me today. It's an honor to be here with you too.
Yeah, absolutely. You first thing I want to talk about, you're a Berkman guy,
right? I am a Berkman guy.
I feel like it's a thing. So many people are, he's the Bill Tierney of D3, right? Like to me, like he's the godfather, right? I mean, him and Begbie, right? Good. Right, Jack?
Yes, Begbie? Absolutely.
Sorry.
Bugby. Oh, Bugby. Yes.
Yeah. That they're like the godfathers of Division III. I want to go all the way back and talk about playing for him as a goalie, because that's got to be a wild experience for you.
It was challenging, but I think the one thing about Coach Berkman is there's no off button ever. And that's probably what's made him so successful over the years. And he brings out the best of you, and it's straight and it's poignant and it can be tough. But I think everybody that's played for him always feels like they're a way better player in person for playing for him. And I think that's the other thing too. Everyone talks about all the titles and all the games he's won, which he deserves that. I wish there was more talk about the lives he's changed and the success of a lot of the players that have come through there. And like, I say this as a proud alum, like it's not like Salisbury is a Harvard, yet there's guys that come out of there with fantastic jobs that are super successful in life and just great mentors to others and great husbands and fathers. And so I wish more would get talked about what Jim's done for people more than the wins, but he deserves all the talk about the wins, obviously.
Absolutely. Is there anything that he did while you were playing for him that made you want to coach as well? Is that kind of, we talk about coaches as coach generators, right? Coach trees, all those sort of things. Is there something that playing for him kind of awoken in you, made you want to be a coach?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually had no idea what I wanted to do in my life when I was there, to be honest with you. And he kind of pulled me aside. It was kind of midway through my senior year there, which was my fifth year of college. And he just said, look, like, I think you could be pretty good at this. Why don't you think about it? And let's talk about it at the end of the year. So there was that summer after, it was the summer after my senior year. We had won the national championship. We played Middlebury for the national championship. I think it was like maybe June or July. I was still down in Salisbury, just kind of hanging out. And he said, I think I'd love you to stay around and just be a part of the staff. And he couldn't pay me anything. He could get me a job at one of the local bars. And I was kind of a volunteer on his staff, and off and away I went.
What was the experience like after playing for him, coaching with him? Did he treat you any differently now that you were a coach?
He was even harder. Yeah. He was even harder. The one thing about Jim is like he'll never ask anybody to do something he wouldn't do himself. And that man works 24/7. And that's probably one of the things I've always taken away. Even as a player, like he never asked us to do things that he wouldn't do himself. Like, and I think that's one reason he's been so successful is guys know he's asking so much of them, but they see how much of he's working at it. I mean, this is a man that like drove himself to the hospital when he had a heart attack.
Crazy.
Like that. I mean, it's just, and so like, that's when people say they're all in, like Jim Berkman's all in. And as a coach, he demanded a lot out of me, and I appreciate that he did.
Coach, you grew up in Maryland, and as you said, went on. You actually played at Michigan State first, correct?
Yeah, I actually grew up in upstate. That's why I'm repping the hat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm an upstate guy. So I grew up in Syracuse. But yeah, I did go to Michigan State and played 2.5 years there, basically. They made the decision to drop Division I lacrosse in February of 97, if I'm getting my dates right.
Just like UNH.
Yeah.
UNH did it that year, too.
Yeah. And so we decided as players, the school wanted us to play that final season, like those last few months. And we just met as a staff. Coach Kimball, who is the head coach, says, hey, if you guys want to play, I'll coach you. If you want to leave, I'll back you on that too. So we took a team vote, and it was pretty, I don't know if anybody voted yes. Like, we decided to shut that season down as players. And then it just became a couple guys transferred to Syracuse right away. Kevin Sheedy and Chris Clark went to play there. The rest of us kind of sat out the rest of that spring at Michigan State, just finding homes for the next year. It was pretty wild. It was like a weird, that's before the transfer portal, right? So yeah. It was like this weird like time of like Coach Kimball would be like calling your house being like, you gotta get, and no one had cell phones back then. So like, he'd be calling your house and like, hey, you got to come to the office. Like, this staff wants to talk to you, or this staff wants to talk to you. It was like this fire sale of like players for like the next 3 or 4 months. That was just odd. It was like a really odd time for a lot of us. So, but yeah. Yeah. It's interesting you talk about UNH. Cause like, I think my sophomore year we played at UNH and we played St. John's, Boston College, or the teams that were there were Michigan State, St. John's, Boston College, and UNH. And with like 4 or 5 years later, nobody had a team for a while till St. John's had brought it back. So we all kind of joked that it was almost like a celebrity death match of programs. Like, we're like, we all played, and then like 4 years later, no one was playing lacrosse at some of those schools, which is a shame.
Yeah, I remember it because I was graduating high school, and I was a UNH kid. Like, I was like ready to go. And I mean, I wasn't really recruited or anything, but I was like, I'm going to walk on. I'm going to go play at UNH. It's going to save my family a ton of money. And then they cut the program. I was like, no, I'm going to play college lacrosse. And then I PG'd. Like, it was just one of those things. And it's funny, like, people in New Hampshire, I always bring up, like, why do you hate UNH? I'm like, this is why. I hate them. Like, they right. cut this program. Like, it was going to be like a tradition. We're going to start that in the family. It was going to be like a big thing. But yeah, it's one of those things, like, it's no disrespect to the club programs at all. It's just like, it's more being upset at the university for not backing you up or like not thinking yeah. you're worth it. Like, it's a hard thing. They cut baseball. UNH cut baseball as well. And there's a really big prospect from my high school going there for baseball. And it really like ruined it. It was like upset yeah. like for a long time.
No, I get that. Like, I mean, I'm a big Michigan State fan now, but there probably was like a good 10 years before I got to that point to bring myself back to be able to appreciate being a one-time varsity athlete for the school, because I certainly was bitter at how it was handled, just because too, and I didn't touch about this, like there were rumors circulating like 3 or 4 months before that decision. And if they had done it, there was no good way to do it, but they should have just pulled the plug 3 or 4 months earlier, not do what they did, which was get us into February, pull the plug, and then try to have us play out the season.
Right. And back then there was different eligibility rules too. Like if you played in the fall, you basically like, that happened to me. I lost a year because I played right. and I transferred, and it was like, what? And now right. it's not like that now. It's much better, but the NCAA is adjusting from their draconian ways.
No doubt.
But not speaking of draconian ways, but your coaching career is pretty interesting, right? You went to Butler, which I think also, sorry to keep bringing up dead programs. Butler no longer has a program either. It's pretty wild. How did that happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, I joke all the time in the office with my staff that like I'm like a death sentence for Division I programs. So like both programs I was a part of no longer exist. Butler actually came about, and he probably doesn't even remember this, but I was working new top 150 or 205 back when it was at Loyola way back in the day. And Andy Shea, I think, may have been at UMass or Delaware very early in his career. And I was probably at back then, we used to do those big recruiting nights, right? The college nights, and coaches are at tables. And he was like, look, like Butler's looking for a full-time assistant. And I kind of loosely knew John Hind, who was the original coach to Butler, who's now the athletic director at Hamilton College. I reached out to John. He put me in touch with Craig Cahoon, who was the head coach. And I went out, interviewed, and took the job and was there a year. And I kind of saw the writing on the wall there too, though, a little bit from my Michigan State experience of just like, where are we going as a program here? But like at that time, I think we may have had 4.5, maybe 5 scholarships at the most. And right at that time, you started to see some programs really start to go all in. like Jamie Moreau was at Denver, Bresci had come into Ohio State. And so you start to see these, like, the bigger schools making the big investment, and you could kind of just see us sitting there. And so I wasn't shocked after I left there that I think it was maybe 4 or 5 years that they were done too. You could just see they were a mid-major school trying to compete with, I mean, it was, we would always joke, like, if a kid had visited Ohio State, they'd see the Woody Hayes Center, right? The big indoor football building. Then you come to Butler and here's our indoor facility. It's three tennis courts with a bubble over it. So it was hard to compete for, but they did a good job early on in with that program for sure.
You talked about the portal back when you transferred. Obviously the portal's crazy today with players coming and going, to kind of trying to keep track of it. To transfer back then in the 2000s was a lot more difficult, took more time. Talk about the process and how did you end up at Salisbury?
Yeah, so that actually, it was funny. Like, it was so different back then because everything was word of mouth and coaches working with each other. So I ended up at Salisbury because of one of the assistant coaches at Michigan State was this guy, Bobby O'Connor, who had played at Gettysburg. And Bobby wanted me to go to Gettysburg. And I'm a public school guy, which I laugh about now that I'm in the NESCAC, which is a different world compared to Michigan State and Salisbury. But I just was not having the Gettysburg situation. And so Bobby just knew Coach Berkman and called him and said, we have a pretty good goalie up here who wants a home and needs a home. And I actually really wanted to go back home to Cortland. That's where my family had played. And I had a couple uncles that were really successful there. One had won a national championship there in 75. So I was all in on going to Cortland. The head coach at the time didn't think I was good enough. It is what it is. And so Bobby put me in touch with Jim Berkman, and that's how I ended up down there.
Going back through your coaching career, you also went to the College of Worcester, which yep. I actually am fairly familiar with. I think I was recruited by them. They're aggressive.
Aggressive. Kyle, can I interrupt? Was there a school that didn't recruit you?
Yeah, all the good ones.
Oh, okay.
But this, he made actually, the reason I bring it up is because you made Worcester into like a real program. Like it was one of the, this is kind of your nom de guerre here. You're a guy that builds programs from almost irrelevance into programs that are competing at a higher level. You did it again with Baldwin Wallace as well. You were the first coach there. What draws you to that kind of like job? What brings you to that? Do you think is that something you've thought about?
I've actually had some recruits' parents ask me that recently, which was great, just because it's a little bit less of a standard parent question. So it's actually, I don't know, to simplify it, I guess the challenge, but you know, I don't know. Like I shared this with a recruit the other day, actually. Like I think going to Salisbury, and I don't regret any decision about that, but that was really easy, right? Like I was going in, they were really good in 94, 95. We won again in 99. And certainly they've been on a tear all these years since. So going there, you're just a part of the machine. That's easy. What was hard was going out to Michigan State when we were like a kind of fledgling. I think the class before me, or maybe two classes before me, may have been the first scholarship classes at Michigan State. So we were just starting to be able to really compete versus some really good Division I teams. I kind of really reveled in that process of walking into Michigan State and saying, all right, like let's prove some people wrong. And let's, a lot of us were maybe under recruited or felt like we were under recruited. And so for that opportunity to make a difference and to build, I guess that's just kind of translated into my coaching career of just like feeling like there's something at a program that can be better than where it's at. And let's try to get it there.
And I think, you know, you've done that. You've kind of done that at Trinity as well. You've improved the win record, 6-8 in 2022 and 500 last year, had some pretty big wins. I think when you guys beat like Bates in 2022, I think people were like, oh, that's like a big thing. Like that everyone was touting them as one of the better teams in the NESCAC that year. People forget.
Yeah. So year two here, you know, when I interviewed here, the administration was like, look, it's going to take you 4 years just to win. I guess I didn't know. Like, I mean, I had an idea where the program was, and I had colleagues that coached, friends that coached in the league, and Mike Daly at Brown, I'm really close with. So Mike was sharing like, hey, this is where they're at, and it may take you 4 years. But You know, we were 8-6. We finished 8-8 in my second year in 19 and lost to the NESCAC quarterfinals, but we played Tufts and they beat us pretty handily in the quarterfinals that year. I thought we were pretty good in 20 when COVID hit. We were 3-1 and beat Bates then. And I think that was a good win. In 22, 2 years ago, like, and I'll own this, like I've said it to recruits, like that was probably the worst coaching job I've ever done. Like I came out of COVID and I think that I was so excited just to be on the field that I didn't pay attention to culture and I didn't pay attention to like little things. And I think things just, we just didn't mesh. I did a terrible job of coaching that year. And then last year, we were super young. We only had four seniors and we went on a tear in April, which was just awesome. Beating Wesleyan when they were ranked, beating Colby for the first time in a long time for our program. And then we lost a tight one in the NESCAC quarterfinals to Williams 10-8, who had crushed us to start the season. So just watching that season go through last year was just fun as a coach to see the kids grow up before your eyes every single game and get better every single game. So, and because we were so young, we're obviously excited about what returns for this year.
Heading into this year, having the success you had last year, what will be the main factor for competing in the NESCAC?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for us is continuing to age, because we had a lot of sophomores and juniors and freshmen playing last year. We brought in four transfers, three from the Division I ranks that we feel are going to be very good. And so getting those guys to mesh will be a challenge, especially for us where we are allowed fall ball this year for the first time in the NESCAC, but it's only 10 practices. So that's only going to be 10 practices as a staff that we have out there to kind of get these guys to mesh with the team. I know they will personality wise and because of who they are, but just that playing chemistry will, I think, is going to take a little time, you know. So like anything in our league, you got to have faceoffs, you got to have goaltending, right? Like in this league, I mean, you need it everywhere in lacrosse, but in this league, because of the amount of possessions that happen, how fast people play, the faceoffs and the goaltending are paramount. And yeah, I think those are areas that we're going to spend a lot of time focused on this fall for sure, is in those two spots.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite things about watching NESCAC ball is you're basically watching Division One. I mean, yeah. People just like, there's kids that are like 6'4", 220, and they're just going downhill every time they get the ball and they're firing shots. I mean, and the teams play, so like you just mentioned, the teams play fast. So you have to have goaltenders that are ready. You have to get your possessions up, or you're just not going to have a chance against a lot of people just because of how they play. How have you tried to develop your team style to fit in and kind of play against that? Like, are you playing kind of the anti-speed, or are you leaning into it more now?
We're leaning into it a little bit more. Our first couple of years, we didn't have the talent to go. If we wanted to get into that track meet with Tufts, our first couple of years, that though, I get, you know what, actually our first year we almost beat Tufts, but I think they were playing Cortland the next day, and I think they were looking at that game a little bit more than ours. We've leaned into it every year I've been here. When we first got here, this coaching staff was like, let's hold the ball. This is before shot clock, right? And like, we're going to be smart, and we're going to try to 3 yards in a cloud of dust, to use a football analogy, right? Like, it was like slow, slow, slow. I think as our recruiting and we've been able to get some more wins and then like get better recruits every year we've been here, we can start playing a little bit faster and try to play that tempo. I still think we reside a little bit more in the camp of like, we're going to play fast half field, but we're not going to play fast fully through the field. And so like, we push transition in half field situations and loose balls and things like that. But, and it's also opponent based. I think there's teams we can play faster than we'd like to, and maybe we're okay with that. And I think there's teams that we know still, hey, if we get in a track meet with them, that may be a tough day for us. So let's not fully try to get into that track meet. So I could tell you when we play Tufts, we're going to be running that Salisbury game plan that they ran in the championship game, because that was pretty effective. And they made that a half field game. They really did.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the things that, you know, when that happened, my phone just exploded. Right. And I'm just like, because I don't, the Baltimore people, man, I love some of you, but some of you are out of control. You just need to relax.
Well, I actually had spoke to Berkman and his staff on Monday of that week. And he was like, hey, like, this is what we're thinking. And I was like, man, that if you can do that, that's going to be cool. That's going to be good. He had some ability to do it because of the personnel he had. But he felt really confident on Monday of that week, at least to me, talking to him. I mean, I guess if you've won that many titles, you're always confident. But he was really, I've known that man a long time. And he on Monday, he was of that week, he was like, I think we got this. If our kids do this, I think we've got this. And they executed to perfection that first half and really put Tufts in a spot where Tufts hadn't been all year, right? Like being down like that. So kudos to what they did as a staff there.
Yeah. I mean, they lure you into playing their style. Cause guess what? That's like, it's fun. If you're like, let's go punch for punch, you will lose. But I do think there's something to be said for it. When you're a coach and you see something, you're like, okay, they do this. If I can stop them from doing this every time, what are they going to do? That like, that's kind of the big thing that I saw watching the game. I was just like, oh, they're not letting that happen. They're not letting anyone get over the half line without a guy in their face. I so like, because people were just like, how'd this happen? Because everyone up here is just like Tufts by 20. And I'm like, we'll see. Like, watch the game, man. Like, I wasn't in the camp. I thought they would win, but I didn't think it would be like that. And Salisbury's game plan was perfect, really.
Yeah. I mean, I talked to Casey D'Onofo like maybe a few weeks after that game. And we were at one of the Lax Masters event. And I hadn't, Casey and I have known each other for probably 15, 16 years now. And I just walked up to him like, hey, man, great season. You got Berkman. You know what I mean? Like you ran into the GOAT and, you know, and he had an answer for it. And he goes, yeah, that's exactly what happened. So great experience for both teams. And I'm sure they'll both be back this year in some capacity.
We call the recruiting process Wild Wild West. And there's more competition for everybody. There's more players getting recruited. You're at Trinity. Who do you compete against most for players? Is it just NESCAC or is it outside NESCAC? Is it Division I schools?
Yeah, it's kind of all over. I think for us, we try to be pretty smart about who we're targeting a little bit in the sense of like, I think, well, I'll answer. I think we butt up a little bit against some of the Patriot leagues, like Holy Cross, Lafayette, a little bit Lehigh. Not so much the academies. That's a special type of kid and a special experience that kid's looking for. So we don't really bump up to the academies, but some of the Patriot leagues, some of the Ivy leagues, some of the other NESCACs, we find ourselves a little bit in the realm of recruiting a lot also versus Gettysburg, Franklin Marshall, St. Lawrence, Ithaca, Skidmore, some of those Union, some of those schools a little bit. So I think that's, and I bet you for a lot of the NESCACs, they're in that same boat too, is that's the teams that they're kind of, the kids are looking at or having conversations with.
Yeah. I think just looking at your roster, I mean, it's pretty diverse, but you got a lot of kids from New England on your team. And I think it naturally feeds into that, right? Like the Connecticut aspect of it. A lot of Mass kids check out Trinity. I know New Hampshire kids are looking at it all the time. They ask me NESCAC stuff, all my team and outside. How do you blend those cultures together? Because I think that's one of those things that like New York kids versus Mass kids is like a thing on every team. What's it like for your team?
I mean, we have good kids, so they all get along. I mean, I totally get what you're saying, though. I mean, I'm about as upstate as you can get. Other than I wear a ton of camouflage. I don't hunt like everyone else from upstate, but so it's a different world even for me. But I don't know. I mean, our kids, I think one of the unique things to coming to any NESCAC school is the diversity of where all the student body comes from, right? Like, and I often share that with the recruits. Like one of my, I wouldn't say negative, but like an experience like, and I'm sure Salisbury University has changed now because it's been so long since I was there. But when I was there, everyone was from Anne Arundel County or Baltimore County, other than a few, other than like some of us that transferred in. So like coming here, you get to play with kids from LA, Seattle, Chicago, Texas, Florida, New England. Like, I think that's a cool experience for a lot of kids to be able to develop relationships with guys from all over the country, because that's the real world, right? Like the real world is not staying in our cylinder. of what we're comfortable and used to. So I think it's really cool to see the geographical size of a lot of our rosters in this league, that kids just come from all over the country to play in the league. And I think that's a really cool experience for kids. And I kind of had that at Michigan State a little bit. And that was certainly, like I said, going to a state school in Maryland kind of changed that. So I've seen both sides of that.
Assistant coaches are very important for your success on the field, off the field. Talk a little bit about your assistant coaches, Fiorito, and is it Heisler?
Heisler, yeah. Yeah, they're the best. I mean, our associate head coach, Scott Heisler, I mean, he's put up with me for so long. He played for me for 4 years, 3 years at the College of Worcester. And then we've coached together now for like 10 or 11. I've lost track. We're almost like a cantankerous married couple together. We can battle and argue, and he can tell me you're freaking wrong. And 9 out of 10 times he's right. So like, he does an amazing job with our offense and is just so dialed in to the kids. Coach Alex Fiorito played for both Scott and I at Baldwin Wallace for 4 years, was a really good faceoff guy. Does a great job with our face-off unit and our defensemen. So it's unique. I think our staff's really unique in that, like, we all know each other from both of them playing for me, and then for Alex playing for Scott and myself at Baldwin Wallace. And just really unique for me because, like, on a personal level, like, I've known these guys since, I don't know, 18, 19 years old when you started recruiting them. And so it's like I get to go to work with friends every day, and they're great coaches, and they'll be great head coaches. I'm going to give a shout out to Coach Fiorito, though. He's actually getting married this Sunday. So that's a cool experience for me, right? Like when you recruit a kid as an 18-year-old, and then years later, you're going to be at their wedding. That's kind of what makes this business kind of cool.
And you've got a great goalie coach on your staff and a face-off guy. So it's unique at the Division III level to have a guy who has a lot of experience playing the goal and coaching. And you talked about it earlier about the face-off and the goalie position in NESCAC. You've got to have a good goalie and a good face-off guy. And you've got two coaches working with the players.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so happy about the face-offs because, like, that's an area I think too. Like, I mean, you can't even tell half the time what's going on down there as a coach, right? So, like, having somebody that's actually had their face in the mud, literally in that position, like, and can know what, how to teach. It's also not only teach it, but also the mental part of the game for those guys, right? Like, just like goalie, like when things maybe start sliding out away from guys, to be able to get them to come back centered and get out there for the next draw. I think that's like a huge help. Is just, I know as a former goalie, like having someone, and I never did, but like, if I had somebody that I could felt like I could relate to, and maybe not so much from the coaching schematics, but from the mental side. And I think that's what's been huge for our faceoff guys with having Alex here. Is just like not only the skill, but just the mental approach to the position. And I admit, as a coach, and I think all of us that coach, like, it's hard to know that spot because it's just, unless you're in there, like, how do you know how to do that? Like, it's a crazy position.
It certainly is a crazy position. I don't know the first thing about it. I'll be the first one to tell you that. But it's such an important position, possession, especially at those high levels and NESCACs. It's interesting how it's evolved into what it is today and how important that position is.
Yeah. I know, it's funny too. Like, I mean, I don't, this could be like a whole, you guys could probably do a whole segment podcast on whether we should continue face-offs in the sport or like.
No, doing I don't like want those people coming after me. No,
no, yeah, right.
No.
But think about it, right? Like, I'm gonna dive into this just for a second. Is what hockey doesn't really have just sheer face-off guys. Right? Like, there may be guys that are better at face-offs than other guys. So, like, could we ever get lacrosse to that point as a game? Would be interesting. Right? Like, and I still feel like in our sport, the rule changes have made it better. We're still having a guy that doesn't play a lot having a huge determining factor of a game. And I know there's coaches out there that make the kicker analogy. Right? That, like, why is, like, were we making? So I don't know. I don't have the answers to that, but it's something I just casually think about. I mean, the PLL is kind of interestingly shown at times how important, I mean, a couple of guys have rolled out with no faceoff guys on their roster this year, yep. I believe in the PLL.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. That was actually the talk of the summer, is all the faceoff guys, guys that have faceoff experience, like they hate it, right? They're just like, oh, just start eliminating our position at the pros. Great. I mean, even like Greg Grenlian's like, oh, it's sad. When he was playing in the MLL, he said this, when he was playing in the MLL, you're playing against a legend every day. And now right. You're like, not, doesn't matter. It's like, they're just throwing a guy out and trying to take it from you afterwards, which I think that's harder to do in college for sure. Cause you don't have that caliber, right? Of guy, right. Maybe you have one guy that can help you do that, but double polling, I've seen triple polling, like all this kind of thing to stop this thing. Maybe that's like good though. Maybe it's coming back around the circle, right? It's like
right. Not
playing anti-lacrosse or anti-faceoff, but finding different ways to combat it when you can't win it. That's right. Kind of like, you have to have a back pocket plan against the top level faceoff guy, because now everyone's getting such high level training that if you run into a guy that's a top one percenter, you just won't get the ball. So you have to have a backup, right?
Yeah, you do. And I know on this recruiting cycle, I know what we felt as a staff, what our staff felt talking to some other staffs out there this summer, was there was less quality Division III faceoff recruits potentially, because D1 guys were taking multiple guys in a class because everyone's still trying to figure out, is this guy going to be good at this level with these new rules still in place? And so that's kind of made the trickle down a little bit harder at our level, because the amount of guys that have had opportunities, and rightfully so, to be up at the next level. It's also why the transfer portal is filled with faceoff guys come spring and at the end of the year, because multiple guys are going to each Division I school. One guy becomes the guy. The next guy usually is looking for a home.
Yeah. It's just like, I mean, you brought it up, but it's just like being a goalie. Like, right. There's only one goalie on the field. There's only one guy taking a faceoff, and then he's gone. At least the goalie stays in the whole time.
Right.
Like, it's such a competitive thing now. And it's funny you bring that up. I did notice, like, looking at commits just for 24s even, I'm like, this guy already got one of the top 10 guys. Why are they taking another one? And it's like, they have to, right?
Right.
It's a big part of it.
Huge.
Coach, you're heading into your seventh year as the head coach. Tell me a little bit about what you've learned over the years and what you like so much about Trinity College.
Yeah, I've learned over all the years that I don't have the answer to everything. I really, it's funny when you're young and you're like so anxious to become a head coach and you think you're ready, and then you really sit in the chair and you're like, oh crap. I'm not fully ready as I thought. And no, I certainly don't feel that way anymore, but I still feel like it all the years of doing this. And I turned 48 in late August here, that I'm still learning. And then so as a coach, that is actually a positive thing. And it's growth is good for all of us. But I've also learned over the years, like, I coach differently now than I did in the past. And I used to definitely be a yeller and a screamer. And I've found a way now, I think, to harness that internally more than project that out. And I think that's something that's changed a lot for me. And I think it's probably changed a lot for some of us, right? Like,
so do you do you find that the players are more receptive to your approach now than before?
I do. And that's not a statement on kids or anything. I just think, like, I think it's easy to listen to the tone more than the message, right? So if you can actually, this is just my thought, what I've learned about myself, like, if I'm just better about the tone with the same message, it seems to stick quicker, right? Like,
yeah.
And so it's just something I've been really conscious, really, really the last like 8 years of like being a better also communicator 24/7 with the players on the team, the best that you can. And I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges or changes for me, is like, kids now have the ability to get information whenever they want, right? Computers, phones, like, I didn't have that. And so like, I'm trying to really be really, really good about constant, not over the top, but constant, more constant communication with our players, because I think that's what a lot of kids now are just used to, because of the ability to have information come quicker. And so that's something I've tried to make changes on for myself. You know, what I love about Trinity, we have athletic tradition here. I love that. I love the kids that we get here institutionally. I love Hartford. Hartford gets kind of a little bit of a black eye in New England, but being an upstate guy and a Syracuse guy, like, I'm kind of used to like that Rust Belt kind of blue collar city that could maybe use some love. And I really like that us here as an institution have embraced Hartford, like as a college, like Trinity has embraced Hartford. And I really appreciate that. And that's something that has really hit home for me over the time that I've been here.
It's like New England's Philly.
Yeah, no doubt.
I was going to say Buffalo to go upstate for you, but I changed it to Philly at the last second. Cause that's kind of how I feel about, I mean, listen, it might be Connecticut's Worcester. That's probably a better analogy.
Yeah.
I don't know. Jack, what do you think?
I agree with you.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was a first for everything.
Capital of insurance.
Yeah. I actually, Hartford's not bad. I've seen some cool stuff in Hartford. I've gone to some shows. I watched some like the art part of Hartford is actually really cool. Like there's a lot of different parts of that.
There really is. And there's actually a lot to Hartford. It's just, I think people have to like get themselves here and get into it. And I say the same about things back at Syracuse, like, but it's, and I think too, like, I don't know, I root for Hartford, maybe for the same reason that I've always taken programs that are struggling. Maybe I just like the underdog, and maybe that's how I feel about Hartford. But it's hard to get yard goat tickets down here for the minor league baseball game. Like, people down here are really passionate about their Hartford teams.
Yeah.
And that's kind of cool. I mean, there was a little bit of rumblings that the governor wanted to get the Whalers back, and you would have thought, like, I mean, like, this place was like, that was like the talk. Are the Whalers actually going to come back? And I think that's probably a long shot, but it would be cool.
Well, you got two guys you don't have to sell, because I went to college in Worcester and he went to college in Springfield. So we can't say anything bad at all. We have no legs to stand on whatsoever.
Love to see the Whalers come back. Coach, yes. When you sit down with the recruit, in terms of their expectations, how do you relate that to them before they step on campus?
My expectations that I have for them?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, we try to be very upfront when a young man, his family is in our office. And I try to tell them, this is where we think we're going as a program. This is where we think you fit in for this program. This is our expectations for how we expect guys to be in our program. But I even share with families that, look, I'm very conscious of, like, I'm a very poignant and direct and kind of, I try to be an open book all the time. That's just who I am. With that, and because I am actually kind of an emotional person, I tell kids, like, hey, like, it's going to come from the hip. It's going to be direct. It's going to be poignant. It's going to be sometimes without a filter. So I'm trying to tell kids when they sit here and their folks, like, this is what you may be getting. And so that everybody knows when that visit's done, what we're about as a program, what we're about as a staff, what my assistants are as coaches, what I am as a head coach, and just lay it all out there. And if they want to be a part of that, great. If they don't, that's okay too. But at least everyone knows the situation, right? Like, everyone knows the product that they're walking into, and we just lay it out there. Complete truths is what we share with all our guys that come through here. Even, like I said, even about myself, like, I'll sit there and tell guys, look, like, this is how I'm going to coach, and maybe it's not for everybody, and I just want people to know what they're getting into before they maybe decide to get into it.
And what about the commitment level? Do they understand the commitment they're making by going to a Trinity? I know you didn't have fall ball for a number of years. You have 10 practices, but it's a huge commitment, more so than high school.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think they do. And we do our best to consistently share that with guys. I think, and I don't know what you guys see through your time, but I still think there are kids that think Division III is going to be less work than Division I. Right. And it's not. And I share this with everything. One of my favorite things about Division III, I think it's the division of the self-made player, because we don't have constant touches like the Division I programs with our kids, right? Like, we can't have the amount of fall ball hours, the individual workouts. We start in February in the NESCAC. A lot of Division IIIs are at least in January. I mean, nowadays some teams are playing two or three games in January at the Division I level, right? I know Ohio State's opened up a few times that early, in early February. So I think in Division III as a coach, you see the guys that really, really, really want to be great at this, because they're putting in those self-made hours of a player, because we don't have those touches with them as many times as the Division I ranks. As a coach, as someone that loves the game, I love seeing that. I love seeing the kid that's like, man, that kid really wants it. Like, he's put so many hours on his own in the field house or out on the fields or in the weight room. And it's just, I think Division I, and I experienced this as a player, you get told more what to do, when you're going to do it, where you're going to do it, who you're doing it with. And we don't have that ability in Division III as much. So you just find out a little bit more who wants it and who's willing to put in the hours and make themselves kind of a self-made player.
Are you able to monitor that, or you just see it on the field? You just know the guys that are putting the time in.
You just know, right? Like, I mean, you can just see the kids walking into the athletic center that are walking down to the field house with their sticks in their hands, or walking out to the fields to go shooting, or you see the progression from where that young man was a year ago to where they are now. And it's just interesting to me. Like I had a teammate of mine at Michigan State that I think he was really good, and he was a high school teammate of mine, but he was good with structure, right? Like, and I think though, like at this level, like some guys, I just go back to, it is the division of the self-made player. And I think there's something special to that, because at the end of the day, like, being accountable for yourself and being accountable to trying to be better because of your own passion for the sport and your own want to chase down the best version of yourself as a player, and then your own want to be the best version of yourself as a player to help your teammates, is a way more powerful thing than doing it because you have some scholarship money in your back pocket.
I have a lot of conversations like that with parents where they're like, well, we really want him to get a scholarship. And I'm like, he has C's. And they're like, so? I'm like, he'll get, I'm like, no, this is lacrosse. Like, that, it doesn't work that way. And also, like, the thing about lacrosse too is I have kids that are like, oh, I'm going to be a D2 kid. I'm like, why do you want to be a D2 kid? Why don't you want to be a D3 kid and get a great education somewhere as well? Like, why close the door on all these things? And to them, it's like it's almost like a status thing. And, you know, what's interesting is you coach at a very status high place because it's a NESCAC, right? Like, that's a thing that kids are like, I want to do that, right? Like, that's a thing, like, you're part of the goal. But it's interesting that you say the things that you're looking for are people that want to go past that and want to develop into a different version of who they are when they first step foot on campus or after their senior year or whatever. I think that's, like, it's a huge lesson for people to actually listen to. I know, like, sometimes we talk on this podcast, we hammer home these messages and we just, like, slam it into people's faces, like, stop thinking like this. But it's important when, like, a coach at a school that all these kids want to go to or have it on the top of their list tells you, like, it is important to do the things outside of practice, to do the things outside of the classroom and inside the classroom to be able to get there.
Yeah, so I think that's great. I've even said this about myself. Like, my dad would say all the time to me, like, you've closed too many doors.
Right.
And what he meant by that, and he was absolutely right. Like, just to be brief the best I can, like, I was not a very good high school student. And to be honest with you, I'm embarrassed about it now as a coach older in life. And there was a lot of colleges that I didn't have the academics for. When I was leaving Liverpool High School, it was down to Michigan State and Herkimer Community College, back when Herkimer was, like, the community college. And so, like, I had two doors. I then go to Michigan State. All right. I did well on the field. I did even worse in school. And when I was leaving Michigan State, there were very few schools that wanted to touch me because of my grades and some other issues. And so I closed a lot of doors. And like that, my dad would always say, you have closed too many doors. And so I'm very thankful to Coach Kimball at Michigan State and Coach Berkman for leaving those doors open for me. But just from my own hard lessons, I always try to tell people, like, you've got to keep the Division I, Division II, Division III, all those doors open. And the only way to do that is through your play, through school, through who you are as a person and what you represent. And like, the more doors that are open to us as people, the more pathways are just easier and life is easier, right? Like, and yeah. And I'm living proof of when you, that you can get some good second chances, but you know, you also don't want to be limited to just a few doorways in life, because that things then definitely become more of a challenge for sure.
Coach, I have one more question for you in terms of the academic philosophy, rigorous classroom time and study time. Players have to be good with their time management. Do you know when you're recruiting these players, whether they will be able to manage their time to be successful as a student athlete at Trinity? And do you have tri-semesters at Trinity?
No. So we're regular, like fall, like regular semesters. That's probably one of the hardest questions to figure out from a kid is, do you have the time management skills? We talk a lot about it though, in their meeting, like, cause in college, and I was the master of this, like you can do everything that you shouldn't be doing, right? Like there's all this dead time that like, you should be out like doing more schoolwork, or you should be out doing this. It's not go play video games or go back to sleep time, right? Like, cause your academic calendar or your day changes from in high school, you kind of go from this class to this class to this class to this study hall. Where in college, you could have a 9 to 9:50 class and not have class again till one. So what do you do with that time? And it needs to be productive time. And I think that's, we talk about that when young people visit us, and we talk about that in our office all the time. And it's tough. And one of the questions I want to start asking recruits, and I would love your guys' quick opinion on this, is I would love to start hunting down the non-traditional coach. If that young man plays football or ice hockey, but they're more a lacrosse kid, and ask, what are they like in that sport? Like, what are they like in that as a leader, as a player, and their time management? Because I think that says a lot about kids, is how they conduct themselves in the sport that isn't their main sport.
I couldn't agree more. I think we've talked about this, and I was a three-sport athlete, football, hockey, and lacrosse. I think as a lacrosse player, that they're the best player on the field, right? And you might be the backup quarterback on the football team. Now you're playing a different role and you have a better respect, perception of, when you're the top guy, how do you treat the guy behind you?
Right.
And how do you play that position, whether if you're not playing or you are playing? And I think it teaches you so many life lessons that, one, you can't be best at everything. And if not best at something, someone else is. You got to respect him for who he is and then understand what your role is.
Yeah, my perspective on this is pretty skewed. I coached a really small school in New Hampshire, but we are the champions. So one of the really interesting aspects this year, this team that won, we had a kid who was a football kid. And he's talking about, I didn't know anything about the football team, that the school's so small as to combine with another school to have a football team, right? So they're combined with Hillsborough Deering to make a team at Hopkinton. And one of the kids is like, oh, I'm going to St. Lawrence for football. And I'm like, oh, kid's a franchise. Can't wait to coach this kid. And he's playing. I'm like, this kid's a football kid. He doesn't move kind of like a football guy. I was like, what? And then I look at one of the kids next to me, one of the upperclassmen. I'm like, what position does he play in football? And the kid goes, he's a kicker. And I was like, oh, he still could play. Like, we still used him, and we used him in different ways, but his playing time would go down because he would, first he was an O-mid, then he was a D-mid, and then he was the backup D-mid. But he still helped us because he pushed kids all the time. Like, he still played, you can say, even though he was a kicker, I don't like to look at it that way, he still had a football mentality of like, we have to get this right. Right. And that actually like really helped us in like a weird esoteric way of like, why is this guy yelling at us? And I would say that like, he yelled at them once in a drill, and one of the kids talked back to him. I was like, don't talk back to him. He's right. Doesn't matter where it's coming from. He's saying the right thing. So I think that the culture of different sports and how it impacts players is super important when you're building a team and building your culture. And playing time, I think, is less important when you're in it, right? Like the lessons that you learn from those kids playing the other sports and their roles on those teams, like the kid was so good at kicking, he's going to a Liberty League school. Like, that's not a joke. Like, that's a real thing. I'm super proud of him for that. Do you know what I mean? And I'm super proud of what he did for the team as a lacrosse player as well. But that really taught me a lot of you can't overestimate, then underestimate. You have to like give them an even playing field to prove themselves, if not on the field, like as a leader. And a lot of kids get that from different sports that aren't that in lacrosse. I think that's awesome. And that's why I hate when kids just give up sports to play other sports.
Coach, if I'm in your shoes and I would recruit, if you could, multi-sport athletes. And if he's the backup quarterback on his high school team, does he have the same compete level and attitude as he does as the star attackman on the lacrosse team? I think that's a great sign of a player who's going to be a good teammate, regardless if he's on the field or not on the field.
Spot on. Spot on. Yeah.
So I think it's a great question. You should definitely start asking it to recruits.
I'm going to.
Awesome.
I'm gonna give you guys the credit for it too.
Oh, okay. We love that. We love having a little credit.
That's all Kyle needs is more credit.
It's true. Well, that's gonna do it for us for this episode. Coach, thanks so much for coming on. You surprised me, man. I'm not gonna lie to you. You surprised me. I thought it would be a little more, I don't know. I do hear things about coaches. I thought you'd be a little more confrontational or aggressive, and you were very open, and that's awesome. I love to hear that. Like, that's great. Sometimes you hear things and they're not right. So
I will own the fact that sometimes I have the demeanor of an outdoor dog, but but once in a while I could be civilized and let inside once in a while. But I really appreciate you guys having me on here. It's been educational for me and great to just chat with you guys. And I can't thank you guys enough for the opportunity.
Thanks so much, Coach. Good luck with your season. Pleasure having you on. And it was a pleasure meeting you as well. Look forward to watching you row down the road. Yeah. Let me do that over again. Look forward to watching your season progress, Coach, and great job.
Thanks, guys. Have a great day.
You too.
Shout out Dan Arestia, Trinity alum. Thanks again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piattelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.